How many Channel 3s are there, Eric? The nearest Channel 3 is located where? And how many Channel 3s are there? Let's see, of all the over-the-air broadcast digital television channels, would you agree with me the vast majority of them are not on frequencies below Channel 7 because of the impulse noise problem? KE2EJ, KQRI, go ahead and give us some more info on this one, Eric.
Actually, if you search the FCC's database, you'll see there's quite a few. Of course, everybody's tried to stay up in the upper VHF, which is actually quite wonderful. You'll find that there's quite a bit more. But after this auction business is over, just about every channel is going to be occupied. It'll be 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. And then whatever's left will go UHF until about channel 30, I think, or 33. They keep changing it because the last round that they just went through, they didn't generate enough billions of dollars to do it, so they're doing it again.
Because man-made noise, impulse noise, rises roughly 6 dB per octave as you go down in frequency, because that noise is going to be super loud on channel 2, like, for instance, when the power line in front of my house used to arc, I would see these white bars of noise, two bars of noise slowly drifting across the screen when I watched channels 2, 4, and 5. So, I mean, there you see definite evidence back in the analog television days that impulse noise is louder at lower frequencies. As such, Eric, you being a broadcaster, if the FCC in this new frequency assignments assign your local television broadcast channel to be on channel 2, and you wanted to have good coverage, and you wanted your over-the-air broadcast watchers to be able to see your signal without interference, I'm guessing that if you were assigned channel 2, you'd be unhappy because you know that a significant number of times a year when there are band openings from sporadic E and impulse noise from a power line and whatever, you know that a significant percentage of your watching audience would have trouble watching channel 2. Am I correct on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRIW.
QRIW, KE2EJ. You are to a degree. Okay, the TV technology has gotten better, but big, fat, blasting pulses of impulse noise coming from like an arcing transformer or something like that, there's no way you're going to win over that. Assuming that your infrastructure is in good condition, all things being equal, that doesn't appear to be too much of a problem. If the places that are big on low VHF are places that are covering large areas, like, Texas, Oklahoma, right through the Plain States, you'll find some low Vs that are very happy where they are, and they like the coverage that they get. But as we move over to HVS63, even impulse noise is not as big a problem as it is, say, with ATSB, which is a whole other thing. And co-channel, interesting thing you can do with ATSB3 is you can actually fine-tune between the two of them. There's a whole lot of things coming up that's new, but we'll see. KQRIW, KQJ.
By way of that great, beautiful manual you got for me, Eric, from Spagnoli, who did some of the early experiments on digital television and the setting of the formats that we're now using right now, I think he did confirm that the early versions of digital television did have significant vulnerability to impulse noise, and that's part of the reason why I think, for the time being, very few of the broadcast channels have been assigned, particularly in rural areas, in urban areas, very few of those channels have been assigned to the lower VHF channels. Is that essentially true, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRIW?
Alright, let me give you a little piece of information that you're missing. As a broadcaster, you made the transition to digital television from whatever your VHF or UHF channel number was. You were given the opportunity to maintain that same channel number, and depending upon what Langley Rice and a few other things, you got, in essence, to choose where you were going to put to put your digital on that same VHF channel, you could do that. Or in the case of many of the New York broadcasters, they chose not to go the VHF and went to UHF, but they still maintain their channel numbers. So even after the auction now, I'm going to stop for a second. The way the reverse auction works is that you're given a starting number, like CBS is $900 million. And that $900 million is if they went off the air completely. And that $900 million became $600 million if you wanted to stay on the air but move to a high VHF. And that number, if you wanted to a low VHF, right. And that number would have been $200 million if you went to a high VHF. So you get the idea. There's a little bit of choosing here. So in the days when digital started, most people stayed away from where the problems were. They didn't look forward to saying to themselves that the technology would get better and it becomes less of an issue. But even on UHF, we still have the problems with co-channel. We have the problems with impulse noise, but it doesn't happen quite nearly as often.
So you're onto something here, Joe. You've discovered that the noise at 46.46, one of your favorite listening channels for fire in Long Island, and also I think you do a little bit of digital television DXing down there too. You've discovered that the noise is getting continuously louder, probably because of more of the kinds of lighting systems that are being used for parking lots and whatever. The spot where you drove your car, where you saw the greatest amount of noise recently, Joe, was it a residential area or was it an industrial area? Could there have been a nearby parking lot with lots of sodium vapor lighting or whatever? Any hints so far on what noise sources are the strongest ones you've seen so far, Joe? Because I think you're onto something here. W2RYY, T2RIW in the Tech Man.
I didn't go near too many large parking lots, like, you know, there's this, like, a store like Kmart or something up near me, about a mile away. I didn't go up that way to actually measure the, do the type of measurement out in their parking lot or near their location to really know. But their lights are turned off in the daytime, you know, they're not running the lights in the daytime. Maybe just store lights themselves or for some lights inside the store would be generating noise, but I wasn't concerned because they're very, very far removed from me. This noise in place where I saw the location where I saw the noise actually spike up about 10 dB high was actually across the street from me, but it's only in one small area. But I saw it again in other areas too that were much, much further removed away from my from my residence. So maybe it's just something localized to me, more localized than I'm seeing that spread out across the frequency that I want to listen to. I'd have to do this experiment again, and I'd probably come up with something conclusive if I use my HF transceiver. I have a TS690, which covers 50 megahertz and so forth, and that has multi-modes on it, AM, FM, sideband, and I could probably simulate the test using that kind of radio and, use different bandwidths, different modes of operation, actually see if I can actually hear, something better, or if the apparent sensitivity changes or they change bandwidth, which I think it probably will. I think it'll probably go to if I go into a narrow bandwidth, I'll be able to hear something a little weaker into the noise. But this is to be continued. To try to put something on the mobile to try to do this, I'd probably have to do what Landy did, build myself a loop antenna type of arrangement to be able to, track this thing down definitively.
Yeah, there you hit on something good, Joe. Even down at 50 megacycles, a loop antenna with a small diameter, but as long as it resonates at your frequency, will give you a beautifully predictable, figure eight pattern. You'll have a null in two directions if you don't add another sinting antenna to it. And now you do have a kind of direction finding. And so that house across the street from you that seems to be one of the loudest sources, is it really that house or is it coming from that direction from the next block? And by driving over to the next block, you might be able to confirm or deny that. So with loop antennas, you can do some beautiful direction finding at all of your frequencies. Ray, you're thinking of using another receiver. Let me drop. Were you thinking of using another receiver with narrower bandwidth that has more sensitivity? Be careful on that one. If you're looking for a coherent signal, like somebody's leaky local oscillator, a real coherent signal, a more narrow receiver, the leaky local oscillator may have some FM modulation to it, but as long as the FM modulation, peak-to-peak, stays in your IF strip, you can measure that more sensitive with a more narrow receiver. So a real coherent signal, quasi-coherent signal, yes. When it comes to pure noise, no. If you had a receiver that had a 1 meg filter, a 100 kc filter, a 10 kc filter, and a 1 kc filter, and if it had a low enough noise figure, you could really make the measurement of pure broadband noise. The number of dB above KTB, the number of dB above a 50 ohm resistor, so to speak, would be the identical number regardless of bandwidth. Ain't that crazy? The number of microvolts goes down real fast when you go to a narrow bandwidth receiver. But your new, as you go to a more narrow bandwidth, your calibration point, the noise of the 50 ohm resistor, gets weaker. And so you think you're more sensitive. Turns out the sensitivity to broadband noise stays the same. So the only reason why you want to go to a broad, to a narrow receiver, is if the noise happened to have some local peaks and valleys of its noise power versus frequency. I know this is a tough one to understand, Joe, but do you see what I'm saying? That the more narrowband receiver, when looking at broadband noise, believe it or not, does not give you more sensitivity in dB above KTB. To B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I definitely follow you on that. I definitely do follow you on that. That the noise I'm hearing, you know, may change. But from the one point I was absolutely able to look at the noise once it went higher enough to a certain point, and what I could see on the analyzer, it wasn't broadband loss, broadband noise across the entire screen. It was only like one sort of like hump of noise. I saw maybe about 50 to 100 kilohertz wide. That's all it was. And of course, I don't have the sensitivity of the analyzer to be able to look at something and really bring up the definition, looking, you know, toward the noise floor, because the thing is, service monitor typically is about 2 or 3 microvolt sensitivity, and the analyzer really can't see stuff in reality much below minus 100 dBm. Stuff below that is sort of into the noise floor of the analyzer itself. So something at 105, 106, 107, you can't see it definitively. You got to have a pretty good signal to be able to see some sort of definition pattern of what you're looking at above the noise floor of the analyzer. But this will be continued. I'll do some more measurements and see what else I come up with at another time. Back to you.
Yeah, that bump up noise that you've mentioned, Joe, which is maybe 100 kc wide or something like that, could very well be a low noise preamplifier to a television receiving antenna that's broken into oscillation, a leaky local oscillator. Bill, WB2QGZ, has done a number of those kinds of searches over the last couple of years, the ones that were affecting cell phone service up at their frequencies, the UHF frequencies. And so they would find these relatively narrow regions of noise, you know, hundreds of kc wide, and when they went and searched it down, when you get permission to go to the person's house and you find out that in the attic is this preamplifier that used to be part of the over-the-air television receiver, and it's still plugged in after all these years, even though it's not being used, and it's broken into oscillation. And so you may find things like that, Joe, because Bill has been finding those, quite a number of them. He also found out that the industrial heating system is used by places like Walmart. These gas heaters have some kind of electronics connected to them that make a whole lot of noise. And the older style brand name, the older model was doing that. The modern one doesn't do it, thank goodness. And so radio noise and eliminating it, that's an art and science in itself. Let me drop. The number of amateurs within the sound of my voice who know how to make a calibrated measurement in units of dBm per megahertz or microvolts per meter. These are the usual units that are honored by the places like the Friendly Candy Company. The number of amateurs who are able to do that is a very, very small percentage, for a good reason. We don't do that. We're not required to do that. The art and science of doing it is not obvious. Even the instruction we get from our electrical engineering colleges does not make that kind of measurement easy to just jump right into it and understand it. Mike has made those kind of measurements. I've made a few of them. And the history that we've had to go to acquire that skill is very circuitous, if you know what I mean. It wasn't a direct application of something that you were taught most of the time. Most of the time, it doesn't fall into that category. So it's an unusual measurement. You went into a fairly rare science here, Joe. Keep up the good work, and good luck with your search. And hopefully you'll eventually find out what's giving you grief on 46.46 megahertz. And sure, it would be nice to find out that it's only one, two, or three things that once you talk the owner, let me drop it. Once you talk the owner into making an improvement, let's hope we don't have to bring in the big guns to force him to make the improvement. It sure would be nice for you to get back to the sensitivity you used to have on 46.46 so that you can hear the fire department out in Riverhead, so to speak, or out in Montauk Point. And by the way, what is the furthest distance fire department that you've ever heard on 46.46 in the old days, Joe? To be to RYY for a final? K2RYW in the TechNet?
Montauk Point, KF707. How's that? And they're typically running 100 watts or less for power. They don't run big power down there. Stations typically 50 watts. I think most stations, they may have 100 watts, 500 watt line and license, but in reality, they're running typically 100 watt transmitters output out of the base stations.
Amazing. I didn't expect you to come back with such a precise answer for an exact location, call letters, and whatever. So KF707, Montauk Point. You used to hear them, and I guess it's been a while since you've heard them with the signal-to-noise ratio you'd like to hear. I am guessing also, Joe, that 4646 does experience from time to time sporadic E-band openings where you're starting to hear fire departments from very far away. Give me a couple of hints as to whether or not you've run into that one, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW.
Maybe on 4646, maybe I have, and maybe going back a long, long time ago. But you know, then again, things change. You could have departments that go up onto VHF, UHF, or go trunked, and totally abandon low band, because from what I was told from a good source, Motorola is not even making low band radios anymore. They pretty much discontinued that product line down there for low band, so they're not even into that into that product line anymore, so I guess they could see the writing on the wall, and that may be very well true with a lot of other places in the country. But out here, these local departments in Nassau and Suffolk have been on these frequencies since about 1940 or so, maybe a little, some 45, 1950. But they've been on these frequencies for a very, very, very long time, and it's pretty much they're there, and they're not going anywhere. Although most of them use UHF repeaters for the local conversations, but for page apps, things like that, they still use low band for that activity. So, hearing out-of-state traffic on those commercial frequencies, you do hear it from time to time, but maybe because of the actual noise level increase I've noticed over the past couple of years, and maybe you don't hear that kind of stuff anymore.
You're quite a shortwave listener, as they used to say, quite a listener. The next person on our list was Steve, number one. He said he doesn't have a question, but he's always got questions, and maybe he's got one to tease us with a little bit here. KA2YHY, if you're available, Steve, number one. K2RIW, go ahead, Steve.
Can I interject WA2CDL?
There's a small fee involved, but we're going to let you. W2CDL, K2RIW, go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, good evening. I was listening like I always do, but usually I don't talk. If you want to You want to hear an interesting interference problem. As you know, I'm not going to go into all the details, for obvious reasons, but you know where I work, and we have on the job a above-ground system and a below-ground system. Well, it turns out that I got a call because of interference. They could not even communicate above ground. And the conclusion I came to was pretty easy to figure out. Listening to an above-ground system, not only am I hearing the local activity from where it's supposed to be, but I was also hearing a signal from Pennsylvania and down in Maryland on the same frequency, because it's shared, as you know. See, this is another interesting problem, if you want to call it that. Let me let it drop. Stand by.
I have something to say about that, Andy. I'll put my 2 cents in if you're done.
Okay, good, good. Yeah, see, that's a... We could open up a whole discussion about this, because I did a lot of noise measurements below ground with all the radiated cable from station to station. That's a whole other topic we can talk about later on. I can tell you what I did, because there was a problem with that, and that's over a long period of time. But above ground, as you know, or maybe some people didn't know, there was a band opening again this past week, because of the warm weather, the cold front that came through. I was hearing this repeater, or a repeater on the same frequency, 146.85, which I normally hear down in Delaware, and I could key it up with a handheld. So the band was open, and the bottom line is that, the powers that be, they don't know this because they're not amateur radio operators. They don't know what band conditions can do when you're operating locally. We do as hams, but those guys who just use it for what they use it for, they hear stations and they say, where's this coming from? So, Dick, what do you think of that? Back to you.
Yeah, I think some of the frequencies in your world is in the 150 meg region and the 450 meg region. And with those band openings, of course, it looked like equipment failure and it looked like some local source of noise in the metropolitan New York City area. And it wasn't. It was really coming from Pennsylvania and Maryland. And my guess is you had some funny looks on their face when you tried explaining that to them. I'd like to believe that there were very few local sources of unintentional radio noise that your above ground system sees on a good day. Is that partially true, Andy? W2CDO, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's kind of rare. There isn't any too many complaints about noise issues itself. Except for some, if you want to quote this, it's coverage locations that are not covered well because of the proximity of the antennas that are transmitting the signal. So, I mean, we do have a few areas where there's some dead spots that have to be filled in, which have not yet been filled in. So if you want to say the signal is noisy, yes, it's noisy in those areas. And that's only because of the local propagation from antenna to where, the signal is going. So that's true. And I know Joe wanted to say something. In regard to 8.5, interestingly enough, as you noted, there's a number of 2585 repeaters that aren't really that far away. And when the band was open, I can key up the one in Pennsylvania, the WA3GWA repeater, which happens to be, and this is interesting, it's in carrier access. It's not in PO. So all I need to do is turn my PO off for this repeater, and I can key up that one. Normally, I don't hear it here. But when I'm down in, of course, in Delaware, I hear it fine. But when the band opened, when the band was open this week, it was very strong. And that's exactly the same time that the agency was complaining of interference. But I just thought I'd throw that in. Back to you, then give it to Joe.
Andy, you were getting a sporadic E or a, what do they call it now, super refraction phenomenon. In other words, weather-wise, every so often, a moist layer of air down low, drier air up high, creates a downward bending of the wave, and so therefore a signal is way beyond the horizon. All of a sudden, you start hearing pretty loud. That's sometimes called super refraction. Sporadic E is another kind where it actually is reflecting off of a particular cloud. So there's various methods by which lower VHF frequencies can easily propagate over the horizon from places like Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Delaware. And I guess you're saying that similar agencies down there are using your exact frequencies and or PL tones of your local commercial system. And so when you tried explaining to your people that you understood where the signals are coming from and why they're getting here, my guess is the first time you tried explaining it to them, they probably were a little bit skeptical and looked at you funny until you used various techniques to convince them. Is that roughly true, Andy? To B2CDL, KQIW.
Yes, exactly. They had no idea it was a band condition. And I had to point it out. I said, listen to what you're hearing. That's not coming from us, meaning you. That's coming from out of state. And this is, we're receiving this on a handheld, by the way. This is a walkie-talkie with a rubber duck antenna on it. I'm receiving the signal. I mean, that's how strong it is. So, yes, I understand the phenomena of the, I call it ducting in a way. That's the right term for it. But we've heard this before, and yes, see, this is also, I'm not going to say it's a problem, but it's the way the frequency coordination was set up. Nationwide, these agencies in all different states operate on the same frequencies. It's all the VHF, you can call it the 2-meter band, because that's who we are. You know, we're not that far away from this frequency. You know, if you look at it that way. And it's nationwide. This is how the FCC set it up. I don't like that idea. We should eventually move away from VHF completely, but so far, they're not doing it. Maybe Eric has input on that, of what are they going to do about it in the future. Especially with this P25 business that everybody's going to. So that's another topic, Dick. Back to you.
Many of the systems, like the one you're talking about right now, Andy, use a PL tone to make sure only the right frequency gets into the repeater electronics. But what comes out of the repeater electronics quite often does not have a PL tone, and there's no PL tone on the receiver. If PL tones were being used to select only the right signal getting into your handy-dandy, for instance, I think you've got a possible solution there. But it sounds like output PL or PL into the remote receivers is not being used. Is that what's aggravating this problem, Andy? To B2CDL, K2IW.
It's not that they're not using PL, because we are using PL. The issue is they're using the same PL that we're using. I already looked that up. They're using the same one. In fact, throughout all the boroughs, we use the same PL. They don't even change PL from borough to borough. So these particular agencies using the same PL as our agency. Can you believe that? That's the truth.
Yeah, that is slightly short-sighted planning. They assume that over the horizon the signal would never go there. Mother Nature will always find a way to make that signal go there. Some number of hours, days, per year, that signal is going to go to places where you think it doesn't go. You put a radio signal into an antenna, it goes to every cubic meter of this universe. And I'm not kidding. The only thing left to discuss is that under those conditions of this day, is that signal above the threshold of the equipment that you're using. Use the right equipment. There is no such thing as a signal that's below the noise. And someday we'll get into a little bit more about radiometry, that if Joe wanted to, he could measure noise power considerably below the noise figure of the receiver he's using. I didn't say it's easy, but there's ways of doing that. I know you wanted to add some info to all of this, Joe. W2LYY, our noisy man. Over to you, Joe. K2LYW.
K2ACC with a comment.
Yeah, what I want to say is I know Andy uses stuff on the high part of VHF, and he probably uses stuff on UHF. My comment was, I've been seeing on a fairly regular basis the past couple of days, we've been getting these fairly warm days, very warm in the daytime, 85 or so plus degrees in the daytime, and it goes down to the maybe low 60s, high 50s at night. I've been seeing RF channels 14, 15, and 16 on the TV band come up from the Washington, D.C. area, or Hampton Roads, Virginia. So I can definitely attest to what you're saying is happening frequently. And I measured levels through my TV antenna system. When I see these channels come in, you're talking about levels at a minus 60 dBm or better from out of area. And I'm sure that must cause some real havoc on these multi-agency systems up here, because New York City uses frequencies from 470 to 488 for two-way communications systems.
Interesting. Okay, I heard, I think it was W2AGC. Father, for your name, sir, correct me on your call letters and go right ahead with your comment. Comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Hey, Dick, KD2HUC, Steve. I know I was next start with the question, but I'd like to table mine till next week because this seems like a really good topic. And as Joe was talking about his problem on 50 meters, I'm reading a really good article here from our friends across the pond. Let me let it drop. Seems they were describing the exact same situation Joe was talking about with heavy interference on 50 megahertz. And they narrowed it down to a PC power supply. And what actually makes it interesting is that the PC supply was a cheap, off Amazon type power supply, and most of the filtering components were jumped through, which is probably why it was so cheap. They actually have a picture of the circuit board with all the filtering components missing. So I'm wondering if one of Joe's neighbors bought a bought some parts, built a computer, and now we're driving them nuts. KD2HUC, back to you.
Very fine, Steve. Steve, correct me on your call letters. Kilo Delta 2. Give me your call letters phonetically, Steve. Go ahead.
Kilo Delta 2, Hotel Uniform Charlie.
Okay. Somehow I wrote that down very wrong. Maybe I heard HEC, but it's HUC. We don't have to table your particular question. You were on the list. The fact we're a little bit over time is not a problem. So, Steve, go right ahead with anything you wanted to ask us tonight. KD2HUC, I think you live in Comac. K2RIW listening.
Okay, Dick. Actually, my question tonight was hopefully going to be a simple one. I'm in the process of tuning a DX with a trapped element for 8160. And my question is, I'm tuning it at the feed point. Let me let it drop.
Can I ask you a question for a moment there, Steve? What are you using to transmit into this repeater system?
Right now I'm using a D-Tech mobile. Why? Does it not sound very good?
The tone that you guys are hearing is not caused by Steve. The system is doing that. It's something that Eric is in the process of correcting. So go right ahead, Steve, with your further discussion. KD2HUC, K2RIW.
OK, Okay. Like I said, I have my analyzer hooked up right at the feed point of this this fan dipole, and it's kind of far off resonance. Not exactly sure why, but I'm looking into it. But my question is there a means or a method to calculate, using the information I get from the analyzer, being, you know, the resistance, the reactance, obviously I have the frequency that I'm trying to tune the dipole for, and the SWR. I couldn't find any calculators online, but is there a means, using only that information, to calculate exactly by how much I need to shorten or lengthen a half-wave dipole for the, you know, for the frequency that I'm trying to tune it in? Or is it, you know, strictly have to be trial and error? That's my question. KD2HUC, back to net.
Yeah, there's at least two different portions to the question you're asking, Steve, and it's a good one. If I was building a dipole for a known frequency, 80, 40, 20, 15 meters, so to speak, and I'm making it a 14-gauge wire, and I'm putting it the right number of feet above the ground, so it's a quarter wavelength or whatever, so I'm not getting a large amount of ground reflection, then there's a formula we all know about, which allows us to, you take 95% of the half-wave speed of light, make the wire that long, and you'll be extremely close. And with a modern-day antenna tuner, no problem. In fact, almost any dipole you build with an antenna tuner, you're going to make it work. Once it's resonant, you've got it made. Let me drop it. Now, if your particular dipole is being mounted a small number of feet above the metal gutters of your house, which is now detuning it, or it's a small number of feet across the, above the ground, or you're bending it in order to fit it onto the property, there's various ways you can modify the dipole so that the impedance changes, and it can be modeled. In other words, there are computer modeling programs. NEC, N-E-C, Numeric Electronic Code is what it stands for. The NEC, the NEC series of modeling programs. You can put your exact dimensions and lengths and whatever and directions of the portions of the dipole into the program, and it'll tell you exactly what the impedance is. That's one approach that I'm talking about. Let me drop. And nice thing about radio antennas is that they all scale. You can take somebody's beautiful design of an antenna that's designed for 1,000 megacycles, and you decide you want to build a version of it at 28 megacycles instead of 1,000. If you change every one of the dimensions, diameters and lengths and whatever, by that ratio of wavelength, you'll get the exact same antenna on the new frequency. That's another way of looking at it. A third way of looking at it is that if for size restriction reasons, for instance, you're forced to make the dipole shorter than the desired length, and you want to know what impedance you're going to get, the set of curves called Brown and Woodward curves, Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, measured every possible diameter and length of dipole-like structure. They did that in 1945-46 while they're working at Bell Labs, published that information. It is a series of graphs. One graph tells you the resistive component of impedance versus length. The other one tells you the reactive component of impedance versus length. You look at those two graphs, and you've got the exact answer. Once you know the diameter to length ratio of your monopole slash dipole, and once you know its length, let me drop. And those curves are available to you on both of the supporting websites, both on amateurradio.tangovictor and also on limarktechnet.com. The article by K2RIW that's in those two areas will tell you how to get a perfect impedance match to any dipole in any location. The dipole could even be part of a Yagi, and you're disturbing the directors and current and the reflector and whatever, and disturbing the impedance of the dipole. You can make the impedance of that dipole perfect by that article, and believe it or not, all you're going to do to make it perfect is to adjust the length to make the resistive component which you want. You're always going to have a reactive component left over that's predictable, and you put the right size capacitor across the terminals of the dipole, and now the impedance becomes perfect. So sentence out of it, Steve. But I wonder if what you've heard so far is starting to make a little bit of sense. KD2HUC, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, so now I have two questions in response to what you gave me. One, you said an antenna tuner is the easiest approach. One of the problems that I have utilizing an antenna tuner is having the tuner down in the shack. There's about 200 feet of coax in between the dipole and the tuner. And according to some of the measurements I took and some of the calculators I found online, I'm losing anywhere between 4.3 and 8.2 decibels to that cable, even though the tuner is forcing everything into resonance. So obviously that's something I'm looking to remedy. Let me let it drop. And the other question I have is, as far as applying capacitors across the dipole to correct it, how do you do that with a fan dipole? I mean, having one capacitor affect, you wouldn't be able to put multiple capacitors across the same feed point, would you? So how exactly would you implement that on a fan, you know, a multi-frequency fan dipole? KD2HUC, back to net.
Very fine, Steve. You probably mentioned that we're talking about a fan dipole, and I may have missed that. Sorry. I was looking up something on the computer at that time. And yes, simply putting a capacitor across it is going to affect all those other dipoles on the fan. And when it comes to your fan dipole, and a particular one of those dipoles is not giving you the impedance you like, and I'm pretty sure you have the ability to make that particular dipole longer or shorter, as an experiment, re-measure the standing wave ratio and tell when you're going in the right direction. I wonder, do you have the ability to do that, or is it too much difficulty bringing your fan dipole back down to make those adjustments? Is that part of what's going on here, Steve? KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, I rested somewhat, you know, up in the air. I only had to lower it like 3 feet to be able to grab it from a higher ladder, and dropping it down wasn't so much the issue. It's, you know, but as I'm doing it, I'm thinking to myself, we have calculators online for everything, and I was curious as to why there's no calculator built or designed where you could put in the resistive component, the reactive component, the frequency, you know, that you're the desired frequency that you want resonance, and the, you know, this calculator be able to spit out, you know, you need to add 2.5 inches or shorten by 3.5 inches, you know, so that you'd have to do trial and error. That was pretty much the source of my question. KD2HUC, back to net.
When it comes to impedance matching your particular dipole as part of your fan dipole system, let's assume it's the 40-meter dipole. And now, as you plot the standing wave ratio at 7.0, 7.1, 7.2, 7.3, you're going to draw a bathtub-shaped curve. And where the best dip on that bathtub is this so-called resonant frequency. You know how to do that. And now, what you're really asking is that once you've got that bathtub curve, let's assume that your portion, your favorite portion of the band is 7.075, and the biggest dip happens to be at 7.25, and you want to know with that curve on the graph and the difference in frequencies between what you got and what you want, you'd like to know what amount of length change, and is there a formula doing that? Not directly, no. Let me drop. Yeah, I know there are ways of doing that. However, if you looked at the percentage of frequency error, you want it to be 7.075, and it's really at 7.250, and you look at the percentage of difference, and you change the length by that percentage, you'll be extremely close, so that the number of trials of your trial and error curve procedure can be lowered. And yes, you're absolutely right. You're way ahead of the game when you've got a long feed line and a lot of loss to do the matching at the antenna itself, as opposed to the antenna tuner in the shack. I agree with you on that one. However, even though you're getting X number of dB of loss, once the band is open that you're using, that becomes a wash, so to speak. In other words, the guy who's radiating 100 watts versus 50 watts because he's got 3 dB of extra loss, very few of the people he talks to are going to know that difference most of the time. We being a little bit more persnickety, we'd like to get full performance out of our system. So that percentage of change by the frequency error you measure by drawing that curve, that's about the best approximation I can think of, Steve, when it comes to predicting the length of the dipole versus what impedance you're going to get. Those Brown and Woodward curves can tell you that. However, they're not necessarily set up for a fan dipole. You are getting some interaction of the other dipoles that are there in your fan dipole. They're fairly small interaction, but there's an amount there that's more than you'd like. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Fair enough. Okay, thank you, Dick. That was that answered my question. That's why there are no calculators online to do that. I'm thinking that I'm going to try and get it to resonate to the middle of the band as best I can. And then I think ultimately the only thing I'm going to be able to do is a remote tuner. Unfortunately, a remote tuner at the legal limit is a bit on the pricey side, but I'm thinking that's really the only way I'm gonna be able to mitigate the issue. I mean, I have half inch heliacs going out there, and even so, I'm measuring, like I said, 4.3 to 8 dB. More than half my power is heating up that heliac. KD2HUC, back to that.
Yeah, there's another question I was going to ask you about this. Why can't I not think of it right now? Oh, yes. On your worst band, what's the magnitude of the worst biswire you've got right now, Joe? Steve, what's the magnitude of the biswire you've got? And if, for instance, it was a 40-meter band, are you seeing this bad biswire at the high end of the band, the low end of the band, and the other end of the band is quite a bit better? Give me a few specifics of the dipole that you would like to correct. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I started on the 10-meter band because that's what the instructions, indicated, that you should start on the highest band and work your way down. Funny you should bring up 40 meters because 40 meters is so bad that I can't even tune it using the tuner in the shack. And I'm assuming the length of the cable has something to do with that. I may have to add or subtract some cable in order to bring 40 meters into the realm of the tuner. 40 meters is actually, for some reason, it's only resonant outside of the actual usable band. I'm not really sure, but you did mention gutters, so that's a possibility. I'm only about 5.5 feet above my gutter. KD2HUC, back to that.
Yeah, there's a slim chance you're running into resonance of the gutter nearby or something like that. A 40-meter dipole is in the vicinity of 66 feet long. Is your dipole at 65 feet in that vicinity? Is your 40-meter dipole and that fan dipole roughly that length, Steve? Go ahead.
Yeah, I would say 60 feet or so. That element is actually trapped. I believe according to the instructions, it's using a multiple. So I believe that element, there's only three elements on the fan dipole. It does 10, 15, 20, 40, 80, and 120. So exactly how I believe it has to do with multiples. It is trapped. Like I said, that element is trapped, and it's about 60 or so feet between the traps. I can actually send you the cut sheet on the antenna if it's helpful.
Yeah, the average guy who builds a fan dipole really builds a full half-wave dipole on each one of those bands and just simply connects them all together with a reasonable amount of spacing at the far end. Yours is a less than the number of dipoles, and it's got loading coils. There could be an error in that loading coil. It sounds to me like this is a commercially made antenna. It's supposed to work on 40 meters, and now I'm not so sure that your gutter nearby is the cause. There could be an error in that loading coil. When you say 40 meters is so high, you can't even match it with your antenna tuner in the shack. Are we talking about like 10 to 1? How bad is it? And for there to be that big an error, when the length is approximately right and it's got that loading coil, I think there's an error in that loading coil that should be searched down now. Steve, KD2HUC, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, to answer your first question, how bad is it? It's bad enough that I can actually, I can arc the antenna tuner if I try and, you know, if I try to tune it up at full power. I never get the vis war below, and this is an approximation, probably 4 to 1, 5 to 1, somewhere around there. It's hard to tell on the meter on the tuner, but, It will, you know, at higher powers, it will, you do hear the arcing in the coil. So, I've only tried tuning it up at low power. As far as the links between the coils, what they do is they actually provide additional wire so that you can jump on the interior terminals of the loading coils and kind of extend the elements out, kind of to give more length out between the coils without affecting the overall length of the element with the coils, if you understand what I'm saying. KD2HUC, back to net.
Hey, you've just given us some darn good information here, Steve. If the 200 feet at half-inch heliax going into that fan dipole on 40 meters, the standing wave ratio is so high that you arc over an antenna tuner. And when you use the antenna tuner the best you can, you only get it down to a 4 to 1. What you're describing, Steve, is almost a dead short circuit or a dead open circuit at 40 meters. I'm beginning to think that one of those loading coils is either perfectly shorted or perfectly open. I think you've got to do a very serious mechanical inspection of that loading coil. What you're describing is not just a little bit of a length error. If I took a 66-foot long half-wave dipole on 40 meters, and I made it 56 feet instead of 66 feet, if I made 10 feet of error in the length of the dipole, which is huge, I wouldn't end up with a standing wave ratio anywhere near that high. You've got one of those loading coils or one of the connections to it, or the connection to the fan itself. There's something mechanically dead wrong with that loading coil or something connected to it. You started off with a good logical conclusion here, Steve, that you've got to readjust the length. We're not talking about a minor error here. We're talking about a huge error that should show up as a mechanical inspection. KD2HUC, in which case, if it is that, and you find it, life's going to get a lot easier. KD2HUC, K2LAW, the TechNet.
KTUPS with a question.
20 meters, which, I mean, is a multiple, I can tune up 20 meters without a problem. And wouldn't it, if there was a fault affecting 40 meters, wouldn't it also affect 20 being a multiple? Or am I just using common sense where other thoughts should apply? KD2HUC. Back to net.
Yeah, the way you just mentioned it is exactly right. And it's quite possible that Rich, KTUPS, has direct knowledge of this exact antenna. He's got direct knowledge of a lot of antennas. Let's see what Rich has got to say. K2UPS, driving slowly through Pennsylvania is my guess. K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Good evening, Dick, and
that. No, I'm still in Ohio. I'm near St. Clairsville. KTUPS mobile. I'm still confused about his antenna because he's mentioned loading coils and he's mentioned traps. And then there's some debate over how many wires are in this fan dipole, and I heard him say that there's just two. To me, that just sounds like a regular trap dipole, not a fan dipole. So how many actual physical wires are connected to the feed point? And are they, I need clarification, are these traps or are they loading coils?
Okay, yes, Steve. How many wires, what brand name, what model number? Time for us to dig a little bit deeper here. KD2HUC, take your time. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, it's an Alpha Delta DXCC. It is a fan dipole. It has three elements. It covers 10, 15, 20, 40, and 80. I'm sorry. This one doesn't do 160. That might be the confusion. It has trap coils, and they are on the obviously on the longest band. I'm assuming that they break between 40 and 80 meter bands. What I will do, just to help alleviate any confusion, is I'm going to send you a link to the antenna so you can see what it looks like. KD2HUC, back to next.
Okay, now I'm going to go right back to Rich. He's probably familiar with this antenna, and I'll bet you there's other people he has talked to that maybe have run into a similar problem. K2, Uncle Papa Sierra, you've got it, Rich. K2RIW.
Okay, well, I've had a couple of different Alpha Delta antennas over the years, but I think the one he's describing is actually one that we have up at the Nassau Club at Eisenhower Park. I know on some of the bands, if it's tuned up for the phone portion, it's not going to be resonant in the CW without a tuner and vice versa. But I would strongly suggest, like you did, that it sounds like he's got a problem with one of those coils, and that should not be happening. Something's not right there. That would be the first thing to check is check out those coils. Back to that.
Steve, he's ready to comment. Go right ahead, Hal. Wait for the beeps.
First of all, a 40-meter antenna will work on 15, not 20 meters. So if you have a 40-meter dipole, it'll work on 15 meters. And the other thing, Dick, is against Ian Long, but I wanted to talk about that little magic T. It's as good as a bird coupler.
Okay, you may not have heard the earlier statement, Hal. This is a Alpha Delta-DXCC fan dipole, three-element type fan dipole. And for the standing wave ratio to be that huge, that you arc over the antenna tuner at something like 100 watts or whatever, Steve. It looks like Rich, K2UPS, and I are both of the opinion that you've got the equivalent of a dead short circuit. A slightly mistuned antenna can't get that high in VisWire. You've got a circuit there that is so far out of resonance that you're literally using your half-inch, 200 feet of half-inch heliax as the resonator, and that's what's giving you this huge VisWire. The symptoms you've given us suggest you've got something like a 20-to-1 or a 40-to-1 VisWire. So there's something physical here that's got to be inspected, Steve. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No comment, Dick.
Let me hear from Steve first. Go ahead, Steve. Yeah, I'm hearing Steve on the 975-375, and for some strange reason, the link between 975 and 85, 375 and 85,